Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
Phil Force is with us, Philip C. Force. He's the author of Letters from Limbo. That's his experience with a brain tumor and his perspective since. Phil, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Phil, when we talk about brain tumor, there's a tremendous amount of people out there with it, or they're getting the symptoms and they don't realize the symptoms are there until it's too late. So let's go back with you and your life right around the time that you were diagnosed. What was life like?
Well, let's see. My parents had just divorced. I was helping my father move to Arizona. And I spent pretty much the entire time I was in Arizona with my dad either throwing up in the toilet or sitting on the toilet and throwing up in the bathtub next to me. So I finally went back home. I started to feel a little bit better after I got back home. I had lunch with my mom. And sitting at the table across from her at this Mexican restaurant, half of my body went numb. Mm-hmm. And mom said, you know what, that's it. We need to go to the doctor. An MRI later, they said, Phil, you have a brain tumor.
Now, by the way, when they said that's what it was, what was your experience of that? And I don't mean as the media says, how did you feel? That's not where I'm at. What was your experience of that? At that moment, life had to be a particular way. Now, all of a sudden, you get information that changes life drastically, like in a millisecond. When you found out what was the experience?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was pretty bored with life. I was almost complacent, if that's a good word for it.
Yeah.
I wasn't happy with what I was doing. I really didn't know where I was supposed to be going. And then just this roller coaster just peaked and I said, oh, wow. And I started just going downhill immediately. And I almost shouted, yes, just excited. Finally, some different, something interesting.
No. And by the way, I can hear that loud and clear. There are too many people who go through life. Phil, they're upright. They're dead. They're doing what they're doing. They're doing the mechanics. But that doesn't mean anything. There's no fulfillment. There's no anything. Mm-hmm. And something as drastic as what they've said to you, all of a sudden now it's something completely different. Now, life with it, what happened then? Where did your perspective go? What is it that you saw differently once you started moving through the process of them fixing it?
Well, a big change was my idea of spirituality and God. I mean, I'd never been a person to pray before that, or I had been, but years had passed since I'd actually prayed. I was raised in a Christian home, and I kind of lost my spirituality during the whole rebellion. But immediately I said, you know what? I'm not in control. I can't understand why I ever thought I was in control. God, if you still remember me, Phil Force, I need your help. And so I just kind of gave in, and I wasn't sad. I was a little anxious, but I wasn't really upset. I said, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And I just gave all my cares up to what I acknowledge as the higher power.
You know, a very interesting thing when years and years ago, I had a debilitating disease. And it was one of those things where they told me I'd have to have an operation, and I had probably a year and a half to live. Now, that's 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I remember almost the same similar situation. I knew I had to have an operation, and I knew that if I got in the best physical condition I possibly could, it would be easier for them to operate. So I'm running the hills, and I'm doing all my stuff, Phil. And I was in the garage, and I'm on an exercise cycle, a stationary bike. And I'm sweating, and all of a sudden it hit me. I made it okay to die. That didn't mean I wanted to die, but it made it okay to die. The minute made it okay to die, the stress went, and I think it allowed my immune system to kick in and do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And I think that's the magic for so many people. If they just, it doesn't mean you give in, but it's if that's what it's going to be, that's what it's going to be, and allows your body to do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not stressed out about it, stress puts a lot of stress on the physical body as well. And if you can relieve that stress from your physical body, your body can do better healing you.
No, absolutely. Now, so you had that experience of it. What were people's response to you? You know, you're supposed to be frightened, but obviously you weren't frightened. What was their response to you? What was the support like?
It was really neat to have the family all together for me. I mean, I had friends and family in the hospital with me. And they were all there and they were all worried for me. And I was just sitting there smiling the whole time. I actually, the night before I was supposed to have the operation, I had a few girlfriends in the hospital room with me and we were watching TV and flipping through the channels. And I remember a male nurse coming in to check on us. And, he seemed really surprised to see my smile, but I just love the attention. I was like, I've got these three beautiful girls next to me and I'm just going to enjoy all the attention I can get. And I remember he asked if we found anything good to watch on TV. And I said, we found the Booby Channel. And I was talking about the channel that was used to teach new mothers how to breastfeed. But everyone's just response was really surprised as, why are you so happy? And it was a lot, you know, just because I kind of, not that I gave up, but I gave any cares up to any higher power, you know, and I just stopped trying to pretend like I had control.
Now, by the way, when you went back to your spirituality, your religion, did it look differently? Because, you know, there's a difference between religion and spirituality, and I think the biggest difference between the two is the wall. And I would use an analogy like the bureaucracy and government. You've got government, and then you've got that wall between the government and those people that are the constituents. And religion sometimes acts the same way. You've got that bureaucracy between the true spirituality and God and your own reaction or your response to whatever religion is. How did you see it once you began to get it back?
Right. I actually spend a large portion of the book just reviewing biblical scriptures and things I once believed and kind of interpreting them differently. I mean, I personally believe that there is a God, a higher power. I don't think we necessarily need to give him a label, though. I think when we give label and try to define, then that puts separation between us. And that's why I've got people blowing other people up right now. It's because we just disagree on technicalities of it.
I completely agree with you. How do you define the undefinable? And then when you have, you know, God hates, God's mad at, you know, and et cetera. That's a human trait. How can an omnipotent being get mad at me?
Right, right. And I mean, there are scripture that talks about God's hate, but it's the way I've learned to define it. It's out of his love for his children and not for hate for any one particular person.
Let me give you my, come onto this planet and you get dealt a hand of cards. Now you can play those cards any way that you want to play them. You want happiness? Yes. And I don't think God ever says no. You want happiness? Yes. You want poverty? Yes. You want sadness? Yes. You want wealth? Yes. Anything you want, but you have to go get it. And we have been trained to want certain things. We have been trained to be lonely. We have been trained to be rejected by people, et cetera, et cetera. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, anybody who hasn't had that experience in their life could be over with, let's look at what caused us to be who we are a little differently now, don't really realize that in the end result, you run around life proving yourself right about yourself and you draw to you those people who are going to prove it, the jobs that will prove it, anything you can get in your hands to show you that you're not good enough. And once you cross that bridge, and let's say that, all of a sudden it looks differently and you're proving something different to yourself that you do like yourself and there's more to it. And that's who you draw to you. So I think that transition, when somebody gets a debilitating disease, if they hit it right, and they get that inkling of, let's call it understanding, life does change.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's theories about, you know, hitting bottom, and you have to hit bottom before you can start coming back up and start feeling better. And maybe the tumor was bottom for me. I don't know if it necessarily has to be some kind of life-threatening situation, but it was obviously life-altering.
Oh, sure. And by the way, best thing that ever happened to you?
Best thing that ever happened to me? Wow.
Think about it. No, the tumor. The tumor
really
was the best thing that ever happened to you.
That's true. That's very, yes.
Yeah. Interesting way to look at it. We go through all these challenges, pain, et cetera, so on and so forth. But then there comes that time you have to look at it and say, what did I get out of it? Where was I hiding? Where was my identity? Where's my dignity? And then all of a sudden something happens and you begin to realize all those places you were looking for it weren't the right places.
You know, that's true. I mean, I was very angry before. I was just mad at the world for what we were doing to the earth and just a bunch of just teenage angst and just a bunch of crap just going in that direction. Sure. And when I finally realized I'm not in control any longer, it made it a lot easier. And I kind of just gave in and said, you know what? Life's pretty good. I'm kind of just happy to be here right now. And I mean, I deal with stressful situations at work every day and I just kind of smile at it. I just say, you know what? It could be worse.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No question about it. And now who is Alan and the little girl who loved you?
Alan was, he was a friend of mine. I met him in third grade at Oak Hill Elementary School. And he was my best friend. He actually claimed the title first, I think, but we spent so much time together. And we were each other's world for a while. I mean, we just spent so much time together. We grew up together. And then eventually he shot himself. He shot himself in the head a few years back. It's been a while now, actually. And when he shot himself, it was after a long separation when I really hadn't spoken with him.
Yeah.
And I was really angry with him because I knew he was toying with the idea of suicide, and I was just mad at him for being so selfish. And how dare he, you know, be selfish and want to take his life when it's going to affect everyone else and especially me. Sure. And then I realized after his death, I grew to love him so much more and just understand who he was for me at the time. I mean, he was my brother. He wasn't blood, but he was, I mean, he even lived with my family for a while. I loved him very much. And then the little girl, of course, was his younger sister.
Yeah.
And I've got so much, I've experienced so much guilt over the relationship with Alan and then his little sister. Cause I felt like I used her a lot. I mean, I ended up taking her virginity when we were very young, and she wasn't really a willing participant, but didn't say no either. So it just kind of happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, I've learned to forgive myself for the mistakes I made and for those situations. Cause I realize now that I was behaving in a way that was justifiable to me. And I believe that everyone on earth today behaves in a way that's justifiable to them, but they were huge parts of my history.
Well, but sure, it's proving yourself right about yourself. And mm-hmm. I'm going to go all the way back to that. And it's, you know, time and place, where you are, what it is. And, you know, sometimes you go back and let's say if she went through any trauma about it, that somehow, some way, shape, or form, if she can look at it, if she can look through the experience, because I don't really believe that anybody is carries 100% responsibility. It's a reversible cause and effect. If she looks through the experience, there's something to gain there.
Yeah.
Totally something to gain. Now, was Alan more than just a friend? Was he a boyfriend?
Not for me, he wasn't. I mean, I loved him very much, but strictly, what's the word I'm looking for? The platonic friends. Relationship. Yeah.
Friends. All right. Yep. No problem. Now,
although of course his sorry to interrupt, his mother did accuse us of being gay, and that was a whole other story of us. We were never gay. We did paint our nails because that was what the banger kids did at the time. We thought it looked cool, but we weren't actually lovers or intimate in any way like that. It was quite an interesting time though.
Well, how's this? That's another book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now the whole key to this thing, you know, you've got, you know, there's a chapter on your dad there, the aftermath.
And yeah.
How was the relationship with your dad before and after the tumor?
Well, it was not great before the tumor. I mean, we didn't talk a lot, but I didn't really want to talk with him. After the tumor, I kind of started, you know, feeling like there was missed time and that we really should be talking. And our relationship got better shortly after the tumor for a little while. And actually, I mean, you know, I helped him move right before it, so we were becoming friends right before it. And then the tumor, and that brought him closer to me. And then eventually, I think he felt like I wasn't doing anything to try to get better. And one day he called, and of course I was in bed asleep, and my brother came in, and I said, you know what, I'll call him when I get up. I'm asleep right now. Don't be rude and just leave me alone. I'll call him back. Because, you know, I thought my brother was being rude. And I got up and called him, and he said, you know what, Phil, when I say jump, you say how high. And so you're cut off. I'm cutting any monetary support from you, and that's it. Good luck. So, okay, Dad. I really didn't know what to say. I said, okay. And then he just hung up on me. I said, great. And we didn't talk for a while. Eventually, we got to talk again a little bit, and I moved out to Arizona to work for him.
By the way, I want to throw a word out here. Mm-hmm. I'm listening to you very closely, and I'm hearing a word, and the word I'm hearing is actually, it's control. And if you think about it, if you go back over your life before the tumor, the unhappiness, the rest of it, and I read your bio. And it's control. You know, you're supposed to be like everybody else, but I'm not going to be like everybody else. I'm going to be me. And then when the culture tries to control you, you fight the culture. But it all starts with family. It all starts with what you're like growing up, the relationship with mom and dad, the experiences. And if you're not getting it at home, you're not going to get it outside either until something happens like, quote unquote, the symbolic tumor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I I've had fears of growing up and becoming my father. And I mean, I love my father so much. I really think he's a good guy, in spite of the fact that we're once again not talking. And I moved two states away from home to be with him. He's not here anymore. He moved away again. Yeah. I love him very much in spite of our less than perfect history. But I've always been kind of afraid that I'm going to turn into this kind of slave to money, this consumer, that I see my father. He's constantly chasing after money, trying to get money to survive. And I feel bad because I feel like he was trying to mold me into being that person. I don't want to be that person.
Yeah, but by the way, the more you fight it, the more you mold yourself into it. You know, there's that point of you got to go neutral with it. You got to just let it go, quote unquote. But I think symbolically, you got to find out what it is, you know, what money really means. And most people don't do that. If you could define your life, if you could define the words that run your life, then all of a sudden you could see life. And I mentioned this on the air a couple of times, but I think one of the most important things that somebody can do is project yourself out 10, 15, 20 years from now at a dinner party that's honoring you. And write down all the things that you'd like them to say. And once you've got it, once you really sit down and you've got it, man, you've got 20 years to become who you want to be.
Right on.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. And by the way, the tumor was probably, again, the greatest thing that could have possibly happened to you. And the stuff with your dad, you never clear it with those people personally. What you clear it with is yourself, because it's within you. He's got nothing to do with it. He's got no power. The power is inside of you, and it's the power you give away.
Maybe I'll change the name of my book, Greatest Thing That Ever Happened to Me.
Absolutely. My tumor, my friend. The punchline. But actually, it is. When you really think about it, look at the way you look at life. Look at what it guided you to, your own spirituality, your own way of looking at things differently. Are you going to end up getting challenged? You bet you are. And so am I, and so we all will. But at the same time, the big one that had been plaguing you, quote unquote, that was already there. Now you got a chance to dump it and go on and find another one to plague you like we always do. And that's what life is, one lesson after another.
Well,
yeah. Or something like that. What do I know? I just talk. Okay, now, by the way, okay, I pick up the book. I read it page by page, cover to cover.
Wow.
What's my takeaway? Phil, what do I get? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I picked the book up?
My biggest thing through my experience of writing Letters from Limbo, it wasn't actually necessarily the story of the tumor. I mean, the tumor changed my perspective a lot, but it was the perspective I gained after it. And actually just writing, I experienced so much pain and just so much regret, like I said, about Alan and the little girl and just the experiences with my dad. And by the end of the book, I really love myself. I mean, for the first time in my life, I'm happy with who I am. I struggled with, you know, neurotic tendencies and just trying to be perfect constantly. And anytime I failed, I recall slapping myself in the face just because I was not perfect and I couldn't be perfect. I just wanted so badly to be perfect, so I wanted to punish myself for it. And I learned how to love myself. So, I mean, the biggest theme, I guess, in the book is self-love.
Okay, and by the way, let's go back to something, the definition of how you want to be in life, you, me, anybody. The biggest problem that we all have is we try to live up to somebody else's definition of perfect. And you're never going to do that. I'm never going to do that. At my optimum best, Phil, I could only be the second best you, and I am never going to be perfect being Phil. I am going to be perfect being Michael Ray, whatever that is. So the point of contention is, as long as you're after somebody else's definition of being perfect, and it could be a group, it could be an organization, it could be a culture, you're in trouble because it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Once you realize it's up to you and it's your perfect, if you go to the dictionary and you look up the word perfect, it's the highest form of function. And if you're doing the best you can and it's not good enough for them, you're performing as high as you can. And
that's
if they
perfect.
Don't like it, they can go away.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Lettersfromlimbo.com.
Okay. And can we buy the book there?
Yes, there's a link and you can purchase it. It's actually published on Lulu right now, so you can purchase it from Lulu.
Hey, Phil Forrest, thank you so much for joining us. We're out of time, and thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, good night.
Night.
Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there?
And there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Mac Richtel with us. He is the author of The Devil's Plaything. It's a novel. He might be called somewhat an expert on distraction driving and the devil. It's a novel. He's a novelist. He's a cartoonist. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the New York Times based in San Francisco. And he writes about technology, its impact on society, and how it changes the way that how we work, how we play, how we relate to each other. And let us say, Matt, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, my! Did I pronounce your last name right?
You know what? You know what? It's my last name's fault. It's not easy. Richtel.
Richtel. Okay, I got it. I've got it. I got it down now forever. It's Richtel. Okay, Matt. Let me ask you this: the book in and of itself. And when you talk about internet, you talk about all those things that we use, we take for granted today. And if you misuse it, if you abuse it, it can be used to control and absolutely destroy a person's life or destroy a nation. When you decided to write the book, where did the idea come from?
You're right. I mean, we're seeing it even in the last few days. I mean, the power to use technology, obviously, in our own lives is amazing. It has the power to destroy. I went a slightly different direction in that I wanted to look at what it's doing to our brains, and I built a thriller, a suspense novel around the idea that something is happening inside our heads.
Now, by the way, very interesting point, because we've been hearing lately that too many cell phones causes cancer, causes this, causes that. And actually, you've got a vibration coming out of a phone. You've got a vibration that runs the body. It's an electrochemical factory. And wouldn't it be interesting if you could control the vibration?
Well,
next book.
I'm not giving anything away. I'll say this. There's no technological fix to getting to the mystery at the end of this book. You have to do the old-fashioned thing of reading. But you're right. I mean, there are a lot of mechanisms that could be controlled here. Now, I'm not writing about the electromagnetic influence that you're discussing, which, by the way, is fascinating, isn't it? I mean,
we've
got this thing pressed to our heads. I think the research is starting to at least merit our attention. But I'm looking a little bit more at the science about how interacting with data, even looking at it, responding to our devices all the time, looking at the screens might be having an impact on how we think, on how our brain develops. And by the way, even though this is a suspense story, it's based very much on science. Should I just hit on a little bit of the interesting science
that's
out there?
Please. Yes.
So maybe you can empathize with this, but you've got your phone in your pocket, you feel the buzz, or you see it there on the desk and it rings. I don't know. Do you ever get the feeling? You ever get a little bit of an adrenaline rush when you hear that sound?
I really feel like I want to get my 45 out and shoot it, but yeah, there's a lot because it's who's there.
Well, that's an adrenaline rush too. But I mean, a lot of people say they get a little bit of burst of excitement when that happens, and scientists say that's a kind of a chemical reaction, what they call a dopamine squirt. You're actually getting a little real genuine burst of adrenaline, and if you get that all the time. You get accustomed to it. You actually get basically a kind of addiction to it. In its absence, you feel bored. Now, I don't want to go on too much about science, but can I throw on one other interesting little component?
Sure, go ahead.
So you get a bunch of adrenaline. It can actually, it's like a fight or flight mechanism. You can get a little bit of death of cells in your hippocampus, your memory center. Now, again, I'm not going to go further because I don't want to give away what happens in the books, but let's just say there's some real science about what could be happening to the two main characters in this suspense story.
Okay, well, let's touch on one other thing, because you mentioned about the dopamine squirt, the rush. When you smile, the brain releases endorphins, makes you feel good, calms you down. When you hear something that you recognize that you enjoy, you get that same chemical reaction. The same thing is if somebody accuses you of something. You didn't take the garbage out. Same, fight or flight, you get that same kind of a reaction.
Yep.
And that's the same mechanisms that cause people to become addicted to either alcohol or drugs. It's the same any way that you look at it. And a basic understanding of the way that our body works in relationship to our emotions, in relationship to how it deals with our intellect, would be something that they should be teaching in school, because the moment that you're confronted with something, even if it's at a minor level, did you take the garbage out? Is it a question or an accusation? All those mechanisms hit and you're defending yourself.
I mean, it's an unbelievably good point. And what's interesting about our devices is they're going off all the time, right? So you're sitting at your desk and your instant message pings in, or you're sitting, you're sitting in the car and your phone goes off. Every time that happens, you're getting a little kind of interruption, a little emotional response. Now you say, rightly so, well, Matt, don't we get that all the time when we smile or, do something else? I guess one of the points I've tried to make in the reporting is with these ubiquitous connected devices, we're getting pinged much more than we used to, and at any place that where we're sitting, where we're standing in line somewhere, in the car, as I mentioned, at the dinner table with our spouse when we're supposed to be paying attention, there's sort of a constant stream of stimulation. Now, you're also, again, to your point, it happens all the time. In this suspense story, in Devil's Plaything, I'm taking it a little bit further, but that's the fun of doing a novel that I don't necessarily get to do at the New York Times.
Now, by the way, let me throw something else out. One other thing as regard to this. Family. Family is not the way family used to be. The acknowledgement, the acceptance, that identity and the belonging. You miss that. You don't get that. The kids run out and join gangs. Individuals grow up to be whoever they are and they look for acknowledgement. The one thing about what you just said, which triggered me as you were talking about, a little bit of a thought here, was that when that phone buzzes, that somebody acknowledging you, that is a personal acknowledgement, acceptance, and it's all about you. That in that one moment of time, that split second of time, when that phone rings, they don't want anybody else. They want me. And for most people, there's where that rush would be, because finally somebody is acknowledging me. They want me. Nobody else. They're calling me.
Can I mention, you're dead on. Can I give you a little bit of science behind that too?
Sure. Yeah, love it.
So, I mean, I know this is implicit in what you said, but when we are programmed at the most basic level to respond to someone, to another person. So imagine our, forebears, however, hundreds of thousands of years ago or whatever, in a jungle or a village, someone taps on your shoulder. You're going to turn around for the very reason you said earlier. You don't know if it's opportunity or threat. Well, now with the phone, every time someone calls you, it's kind of like a tap on the shoulder. but it can come from anywhere, anytime. So on the good side, you can sort of get that feeling you're describing of being wanted. On the bad side, it's like anybody can sneak up on you at any time and tap you on the shoulder.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sitting here waiting for everybody to come through from Match.com, and I've given phone numbers out, and they're calling, and I'm all excited. But the next day, it's all the bill collectors.
There you go.
Same, same. No, you got it. Opportunity or threat right across the board. No, I think it's key, and obviously we don't want to give away. If anybody wants to know what's going on with the book, by the way, and I'll ask you right before we finish up today too, website we can find you and the book at.
Yep.
No, go ahead. What is
right, you want that now?
Oh, absolutely. And we'll do it again before you leave.
Okay. You know, mattrichtel.com, MattRichtel.com, devil's plaything, but Amazon, you know, airports, bookstores, I'm very flattered. We're starting to get some really nice reviews. Paperback, so $9.99. You know, what else you got to do this summer?
Of course. By the way, that I realize that it's a novel. I realize that it's quote unquote fantasy. But what you're talking about, and if somebody can get to it at its basics, it's a good way to be in control of your life. Then when you wake up in the morning, your day is not accidental. Your day is intentional. You can predetermine the kind of results that you want out of your day.
Yeah. I mean, it obviously cuts both ways. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So in the book is not just for a particular audience out there. The book is for everybody. This is what I'm really hearing.
Okay. Ask your question again. I'm not sure what you mean.
Okay, it wasn't a question. What I'm saying is, what I'm hearing you say, the book is for everybody, not a specific target audience. Everybody.
Yeah,
will have
I mean,
fun.
Look, this is supposed to be. Can I just tell you a 2-sentence snippet of the very unusual duo at the heart of this story?
Sure.
This is about an investigative reporter and his grandmother who suffers severe dementia. A very unusual buddy story. She knows a terrible secret about the world, but because of her condition, she doesn't know that she knows a secret or what it is. And as a conspiracy begins to befall this investigative reporter, he realizes he's got to get this secret out of her head. And far from this story having to be for tech geeks or science folks, this is about a story about the lives we're living with our aging population. It just so happens that the secret that our reporter stumbles on and that's locked inside Grandma's head has to do with how our lives are being changed by all this technology. Now, I don't want to give any more away, but it's really meant to be a story about all of us and all our lives.
No, I love every second of it. I think it's great. And by the way, I have my copy right in front of me. I'm going to digest it over the weekend.
Well, I hope you like it. I'm really thrilled you have me on. It's great to talk to you again.
Great. Hey, Matt, let me ask you this one more time, please. We're running out of time. Your website one more time.
MattRichtel.com, www.MattRichtel.com, and check out Devil's Plaything on Amazon or any bookstore. I hope you like it out there, and please send me a note one way or the other.
Great. Hey, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you
All I have are these arms to enfold you,
and a love time can never destroy.
If you're wondering what I'm after, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
No, it just begins. Mayor Eisenstein, how are you?
Oh, Michael, my good friend, I am wonderful. I mean, the weather couldn't be more exquisite. A day like this, I have no desire to move out of the Midwest. It couldn't be any better.
No, I know, and we're going to get two, three more days of this before we get winter again. I think it's great.
That's exactly right. I mean, the forecast is snow for Sunday, you know. I got some stuff that you're going to really, really like, you know. You know, we talk about vitamin D so much. And
sure.
I found a study that was done just a few weeks ago. It was in a medical journal called Diseases of Muscle from the American Thoracic Society. And it was at their annual conference. And they were looking at people who have chronic obstructive lung disease, which comes many times from smoking. It's like emphysema. But forget about that. That's still a small percentage of the population. What's most fascinating, what they found was at the end of the study, researchers found the patients treated with vitamin D had a significant improvement in exercise capacity and respiratory muscle strength as compared to those in the placebo group. And so what we could do is we can extrapolate that anyone who does any type of workout program who's going to make sure they have adequate amounts of vitamin D, preferably from a combination of the sun and supplement, are going to be able to increase their workout regimen, kind of almost like being on natural steroids.
I'm going to take another 80, 90,000 units tonight.
Yeah, so let me tell you something. And you know, and let me tell you how much they were giving him. They were giving him too little. They were giving each subject 100,000 units a month. You know, it's just not enough. But is that impressive? That even and so that comes out to about 3,000 a day. Not enough. I mean, but my guess is the people were so deficient because many of these people were housebound. They weren't outside. You know, I mean, this just goes along with so many of the unique properties of being out in the sun. And I can tell you what I tie this back to. Many of the records in the Olympics were set in 1968. We're talking about almost 50 years ago in Mexico City. And it was one of the hottest summers. And many of the events were during that critical period of 10 a.m. in the morning and 2 p.m. where you get the maximum amount of vitamin D. And the athletes would work out in those conditions knowing they were going to be competing in those events. And one of them was the long jump. I'm trying to remember the name of the athlete. His record stood for 40 years, you know, which is just incredible in athletic performance where usually every Olympics they break 70% of the records of 4 years earlier.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. The term muscle disease, you know, what comes to mind very quickly would be fibromyalgia. And there are so many things that we don't think about when you talk about muscle disease. Now, D3, would it help for anything like fibromyalgia?
100%. I mean, you know, I have a doctor who I'm working with, or I should say she's working with me. Her specialty is osteoporosis. And what she was so interested in the HCG program that we're doing, because when we did the body composition analysis, we found that the majority of people are losing about 70% of fat and about 5 or 6% muscle, lean muscle mass. And she couldn't get over that because she said, well, one of the ways to treat osteoporosis, fibromyalgia, all these type of illnesses is to lower your body fat content. I mean, that's one of the ways to do it, but without lowering your muscle mass. And if anyone goes on a calorie-restricted program, I don't care what the program is, they're going to lose 60 or 70% muscle and only about, you know, 10 or 15% of fat. And that's why most of the programs don't work. But now put this in combination, because the vitamin D is incredibly important in this. you add the vitamin D to someone on a calorie-restricted program, and especially the one we're working with, you've got the ultimate combination for increasing or not losing lean muscle mass and losing the fat, which allows you, and the fat's not only in your belly, the fat's also in your arms and your legs, in between the muscles, and it doesn't allow the muscles to contract as effectively. And so we have found very frequently that the people in our program, like myself, who lose 10, 15 pounds during the HCG phase, and then there's a month they're off, and if they start working out in the month they're off, they start putting on lean muscle mass because the muscles are working, not only the lighter, but they're working more effectively because there's no fat in between the muscles.
Now, by the way, let's take this to the extreme. You know, we talk about fibromyalgia, and anybody with that, they have enough extreme discomfort. But, you know, we have organizations like the Muscular Dystrophy Association. And when you look at muscular dystrophy, it's the same thing with muscles. It's just inflammation. It's losing strength, losing muscle. It's all the same thing that you've just talked about. What about the D3 for programs like that? Now, somebody can have it at birth or it could be onset later on. But what do we do in those cases? Can we actually use the D3 to help in those and we're talking extreme now there. Extreme cases.
Let me tell you something. Let me take something a little bit less extreme, but in the same family, multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
Also, something where your nerves are affected and your muscles end up getting weak. There's no doubt about it. There's enough evidence. All you have to do is put MS and vitamin D, and you'll find that people who take vitamin D will go into longer remissions and many times will send them into remission. So it's obviously not a cure for this illness.
No.
Same thing with muscular dystrophy. There's no question about it. That first of all, many of these children and young adults, very few young adults because they die so young in life, are housebound. So even if they're living in the South, in southern Texas or southern Arizona, southern California, southern Florida, they aren't getting outside. And their vitamin D levels are going to be in the tank, as is the whole country. I mean,
sure.
People, Karen, my wife, was at the bank a couple of days ago, and someone said, "Oh, my God, I don't recognize you." She hadn't been in that bank in about a year or so. And she said, "What have you done?" And she explained the program, and then she started talking to one of the bankers. And the banker said to her, "You know, my doctor ran a vitamin D level in me, and it was in the teens. Now, this is something that should be 60 to 80 minimally, you know, and most probably even higher. And how much vitamin D is he giving you? 2,000 a day. The same thing. They're so afraid to give the right amounts, you know. But it's exciting. You know, it takes doctors a realization there's a problem, and at least that's the beginning of understanding that we've got to treat it. If they don't know there's a problem, they're not even going to treat it. I think doctors are realizing that there's a problem. They just haven't gotten around to using the right amount. They're less afraid of pharmaceuticals than they are with natural substances.
Sure, and let's qualify something. We hear that word cure so many times, and you and I have discussed this before. Things don't cure you. Allopathic medicine, they don't cure you, and neither does, as far as cure goes, and neither does supplements, etc., naturopathic medicines. What cures you is your immune system. Everything that we take is something to shore that immune system up. If there's a deficiency somewhere, the immune system is not being able to work properly, and if it can't work properly, it can't help you, it can't protect you, it can't fix you. But if we do the D3, and the D3 connects where you're disconnected, the immune system works, and the things that bothered you before don't bother you. So nothing is a be-all, end-all, cure-all, but what things are is that certain something that's going to boost the immune system to cause it to move in a particular direction and keep you safe.
Oh, let me tell you, so beautifully stated, because that's why the word that we use in the natural medicine, if you want to use that, is supplement. You said it so well. It's a supplement. It's the add-on. It's to supplement your immune system, to strengthen your system. But in itself is not the answer, not the cure. You know, and that's and I don't think people understand it even with steroids. You know, that the athletes who took steroids didn't all of a sudden become home run hitters and better boxers and better that. it allowed them the ability to work out longer, and that's what I think happened in Mexico City in 1968. You know, and I think a lot of people are looking at this. Last year, the team physician for the Chicago Blackhawks tested all their vitamin D levels and realized the whole team was deficient in vitamin D, and he had them on a supplement program. And I didn't hear anything about it this year, and I want to see if it's the same doctors. They didn't do very well this year. Of course, you need good players, and all the good players left. But last year they won the Stanley Cup, and when they talked to the doctor, he said one of the supplemental reasons why they were so good is because their vitamin D levels were at excellent levels.
Yeah, and by the way, the vitamin D3, and then which I take obviously, and then also what I do every day in the morning, the minute I wake up, I hit the bathroom and I've got two bottles sitting on the counter, and one of them is L-arginine and the other one is creatine, and then I take them right before I work out, and that's a good energy boost, and for me it works really well.
And let me tell you something, I've been looking into L-arginine. I haven't been able to wrap myself around it as well as both the creatine and the L-arginine. But I can tell you, I have great respect for athletes like yourself, Michael. You know, I like to look at people who really take workouts serious and see what they're doing, and I like to mimic them. And that's I'm going to be doing a lot of work on the L-arginine because it's been around for quite a while. I mean, obviously, yeah. It's one of the essential amino acids. You know, I'm going to look into it a little bit more because. There's, you know what, now that I'm 100 plus pounds lighter, that I'm starting to work out again, you know, I've got to come up now to Milwaukee for you to help me with, now I need you to be my personal trainer because it's kind of interesting, you know, I haven't been this strong in 30 years, you know,
and
I just started lifting some weights, which I've had in the basement for years, you know, and I'm real excited about this. I mean, it's like one thing leads to the other. I think that's the bottom line.
Oh, absolutely it does. You know, and as far as the arginine goes, the L-arginine, what it does, it expands the blood vessels. It allows blood to flow. And you get more blood flow. It's better for the heart. It's better for the brain. And also, it allows you to put on more muscle mass.
I want to also mention one thing before we finish up. Next weekend here in Chicago, that's June 10th through the 12th, there's going to be a fabulous, fabulous conference. It's called Health Freedom Expo. It was founded by the late Dr. Wendell Whitman, who is a naturopath and has a naturopathic school in Indiana. And his vision was to create an affordable, high-impact forum to educate the public on natural health matters. And now it's being run by his daughter, Julie Whitman Klein, and it's inexpensive. The conference costs $45 for 3 days, but even better, there's a free Friday. And if someone just emails me at Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, at homefirst.com, that's H-O-M-E-F-I-R-S-T.com, I can send them the link to the Health Freedom Expo page to find the free Friday. It's buried. It's buried there. And there are over 90 speakers. I'm going to be one of the speakers. And, of course, they want me to speak on how I lost more than 100 pounds. And I'm going to be speaking Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'm going to be speaking. And as everyone knows me, it'll be three different speeches, even though it'll start off the same because I don't speak with notes. And so every day will be a little bit different. No 2 days are ever the same. But there's going to be lots of doctors talking. There's going to be vitamin D talks, vaccine talks, you know, as well as an exhibit hall with lots of interesting type of different exhibits, you know. And quite a few of the companies are involved with L-arginine. So it's interesting you bring that up because I'm going to be looking at them, just sitting and talking to them about it.
I think, what's the name of the conference again?
Health Freedom Expo. And if you could just go to healthfreedomexpo.com, you can get all the details about it. Or just put in the Google Health Freedom Expo. And they have two conferences a year. In June, it's in Chicago. It's going to be June 10th through 12th. It's at the Renaissance Hotel in Schaumburg, Illinois. It's a fabulous hotel, inexpensive, and you're going to have a great time there. There's speakers going on all day. There's a big exhibit hall with hundreds of exhibitors, you know, and really a fun thing. We've been involved with that now for about 3 or 4 years and really enjoyed it. Not only been participated, but also enjoyed being there as consumers.
By the way, is Rima LeBeau, Dr. Rima LeBeau, involved in that?
No, she isn't, but I can tell you I was on the phone with her this morning.
Oh, I just say hello to her when you...
My God, that's so funny. What a small world. I didn't even think of the young... What a nice person, you know what I mean? And how do we make connections? She is interested in me putting a HCG program. She has a incredible spa and medical clinic in Panama City, in Panama. And so she saw my webpage and she called me up. We've talked for weeks, and I'm most probably going to be going to Panama in the middle of July to meet with her.
Okay, though, and one of the things that she talks about, and I'll touch on this just very briefly, and one of the reasons I'm ecstatic about you doing the kind of thing that you do, you're familiar with Codex Alimentarius?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and that in and of itself, when the pharmaceutical industries, and I'm going to have to say that that's really the driver for the whole thing, starts to control the supplemental industry, we're going to have a problem, and that's what they're pushing. And I think more and more people understand the difference between the two and what the supplemental industry can do for us with our health, then maybe there's a way to get that stopped, talk to the legislators, et cetera, that control what they do or don't do. But if they control the amount of potency, strength through the different vitamins and minerals that we take, no matter what we buy, it's not going to do anybody any good. So that's something.
I wouldn't be surprised, you know, because I'm kind of an outsider of the Health Freedom Expo. I know a lot of the people, but I'm not. But she's definitely, because one of their arms is the Health Freedom Legal Corps. And that's exactly what they're all about. Exactly what you're describing is what the Health Freedom Expo is all about. You know, in fact, here, I'm going to give you a statement from the late Dr. Wendell Whitman. If a person does not know about the health care choices, then there's no health choices. You know, and I think that, you know, that's why it's such a fabulous organization, you know, and a fun time, and one that can, I think, have great impact in healthcare. I mean, we're facing some serious problems, you know, and if anyone thinks that Romney is any better than Obama, you got to be kidding.
I'm
disappointed in him, only because I would think about him if he renounced that what he did in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is bankrupt because of Romney Care, and he's still defending it now, you know. And then he wants to repeal Obamacare. What does he want to do, repeal Obamacare and put Romney Care in there? You know, give me a break.
Well, we got to repeal them both. You know,
that's right.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
but I did have, just for politics, for 1 minute on politics, I got great pleasure today that they indicted John Edwards. This is a very nasty person on many fronts. He made $40 to $50 million suing doctors over birth injuries, claiming the doctors were responsible for birth injuries, you know, which of course they weren't. I mean, but he just spun it that way, and it's kind of nice to see that that he's getting his due. What an despicable person. That's the only word for it. You know.
Now, let me give you one more thing, and then we'll call it a day or call it a night, whatever the case may be. And politically, which I thought was interesting today with Obama's speech about, you know, the car manufacturers and how wonderful they are and what they've done and yada yada. It was a tremendous spin because the money that they got did not go to the car manufacturers. In essence, it went to the unions, and that's who he gave the money to, and that's where his vote is coming from.
Yeah, and let me just add one last little piece here. We as long as we're in politics. His speech a week ago about returning to the 67 borders. I can tell you what that's all about. It had nothing to do with Israel. It had nothing to do with the Jews. This is an anti-Christian thing because before 67, Christians weren't allowed to go to the holy places in the old city of Jerusalem. And put it back into Muslim control, no Christian will be able to go to any of the holy places.
That comment that he made cost him and will cost him more votes because if people didn't...
Well, I'm hoping it cost some Christian votes because that's what it was all about. It had nothing to do with... I mean, since 67, Jerusalem's been open to everyone, every person, every faith, every religion. You know, makes a difference who you are allowed to go there.
Yeah, but see, as a smart negotiator, the one thing that I wouldn't do is if I'm going to negotiate and I have a piece of land to use as the negotiating tool, I don't give it to someone before the negotiations because
exactly.
Then I've got nothing to bargain with. So the entire thing, if you look at it, was childish.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Now, one more time with your website and we're good to go.
It's homefirst.com, HOMEFIRST.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. And if someone wants more information about the Health Freedom Expo, you can just email me personally, Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, at homefirst.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Mayer, see you next week.
Awesome, my dear friend. Be well.
Good night.
Girl, hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. I read something the other day and I had a request. As a matter of fact, a couple of requests to do it one more time because they said some of the people should hear this. And they missed it. And there was an article. There was an article written by an Australian dentist, and the article was entitled "To Kill an American." And most of us probably missed this in the Russian news, but there was actually a report that someone in Pakistan had published a newspaper an offer of a reward to anyone who killed an American, any American. So an Australian dentist wrote an editorial the following day, and he let everyone know what an American is, so they would would know when they found one, good one. An American is English or French or Italian, Irish, German, Spanish, Polish, Russian, or Greek. An American may also be a Canadian, a Mexican, an African, an Indian, a Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Australian, Iranian, Asian, Arab, Pakistani, or Afghan. An American may also be a Comanche, a Cherokee, an Osage, a Blackfoot, a Navajo, Apache, a Seminole, or one of the many other tribes known as Native Americans. An American is Chinese, or he could be Jewish, or Buddhist, or Muslim. In fact, there are more Muslims in America than in Afghanistan. And the only difference is that in America, they're free to worship as each of them chooses. An American is also free to believe in no religion, for then he will only answer to God, not to the government, or be, or to armed thugs claiming to speak for the government and for God. An American lives in the most prosperous land in the history of the world. The root of that prosperity can be found in the Declaration of Independence, which recognizes the God-given right of each person to the pursuit of happiness. An American is generous, and Americans have helped out just about every other nation in the world in their time of need, never asking for a thing in return. When Afghanistan was overrun by the Soviet Army 20 years ago, Americans came with arms and supplies to enable the people to win back their country. And as the morning of September 11th, Americans had given more than any other nation to the poor Afghanistan. The national symbol of America, the Statue of Liberty, welcomes your tired, your poor, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores, the homeless, tempest-tossed. These, in fact, are the people who built America. Some of them were working in the Twin Towers the morning of September 11th, 2001, earning a better life for their families. And it's been told that the World Trade Center victims were from at least 30 different countries, cultures, first languages, including those aided and abetted the terrorists. So you can try to kill an American if you must. Hitler tried. So did General Toho, Stalin, Mao Zedong, and other bloodthirsty tyrants in the world. But in doing so, you would just be killing yourself, because Americans are not a particular people from a particular place. They are the embodiment of the human spirit of freedom. Everyone holds to that spirit. Everyone is an American.
This piano is for you. Charlie worked hard for it.
See, God wouldn't have made you suffer so much if he wasn't going to make up for it later.
How happy you can be up the lazy river with me.
Troubles, baby, dream a dream with me.
Up a lazy river with me.
Somewhere floating around the control room is the angel of the control room. And the angel looks down over the board, and the angel says, is there a guest, or is that or not a guest? And we'll wait for the sound of the angel to speak to us. Thank you, angel. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And as a matter of fact, Monica Strobel is with us. She is the author of The Compliment Quotient. It's called Boost Your Spirits, Spark Your Relationship, and Uplift the World. And in writing The Compliment Quotient, she was a complimentologist, and that's a great word. Monica drew on a wealth of professional expertise and practical experience. She had long recognized for her, she's been long recognized for her inspiring can-do attitude that uplifts others, and that's a great approach. And let us say, Monica, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about the compliment quotient, how many people go through life and never get a compliment?
Right. People are hungry for appreciation. Definitely a very common denominator. I believe it was William James who said, the deepest principle of human nature is the craving to be appreciated. So,
yeah, it's interesting. I'm looking at your press release here, and a very interesting thought popped as I'm looking at this. You call it the compliment coach. Do people need to be trained how to compliment?
Well, it's not necessarily that they need to be trained, but they need to have it brought out in them. You know, they definitely do, because a lot of people, believe it or not, hold back on compliments for a variety of reasons. And I think one of the saddest ones is they'd rather hold back saying something nice about someone than come across as, kind of soft, or perhaps that they're, sucking up to them, or, maybe complimenting them wrong or out of order. So there's other people feel like, wow, if I shine the light on that person, that's going to take something away from me. So there's kind of a pie mentality, like they get a bigger piece of the pie, I'm going to get less, rather than really it's a ripple effect. And the cool thing about compliments is it ripples out and then it ripples back to you, because whoever is complimenting gets highlighted in that person's eyes. Wow, they recognize something about me. So they're special too.
Yeah, that was interesting. There was something I'm going to read that's part of your press release, and I think it's absolutely amazing. A new report based on 2,000 British adults found that the three-year glitch has been replaced with the seven-year itch as the tipping point when couples start to take each other for granted. I imagine that at that point, the compliments start to go away because they don't think they need them anymore, and they don't realize that you've got to be the way you were 5 years from now as you were on day one.
Sure. It takes a bit extra time to actually compliment because, and that is one of the great things, though, about it, why you want to activate that, because you can't compliment someone if you're not finding something positive. And how often do we as partners in a longer-term relationship start to focus on the negative things, you know, the things that irritate us? Our husband unloads the dishwasher, but he leaves crumbs on the counter, and we don't ever compliment him on doing that. We just focus on the crumbs. And by deciding to get into a compliment habit, you're actually going to turn that around and refocus your attention, even momentarily. Sometimes that's all you can do, on the positive.
No, realistically, I think you bring up an absolutely great point, because the other part of this with the report that came out, along with diminishing romance, the report revealed a steep decline in compliments partners give each other. So realistically, there is kind of a trend that goes on within a relationship. The relationship, you know, the excitement starts to wear off. You get comfortable with each other, and now your family, you take each other for granted, and you don't stop and think what that's doing to either one of the partners.
Absolutely. You fall into a lot of routine, and it's easy to think that, oh, this partner is oh so familiar, there can't be anything new that I could compliment them on. And that really is a mistake, because taking for granted and feeling taken for granted are those forces that are working to translate the, you know, the marriage into having this three-year glitch, which is scary. You know, marriage is being in trouble sooner. And the way to get around that taking for granted is to focus in, be present, and look for something positive, which usually kind of, you know, gives you a jolt, a remembrance of, wow, that was what attracted me to that person. And it kind of jumpstarts some of that passion and attraction that you used to feel.
And we're talking about a practical way of doing it. I think that's extremely important to say. It's a practical way of doing it, not running in the house and smiling in the middle of everything and giving these compliments where they know it's garbage. It's that practical, every day, this is what we do. I had mentioned this the other day on the air, and I thought it was extremely important. It was somebody who was on years ago, and they were talking about relationships, and what they had done was every Sunday night at 7 o'clock, they kissed. That didn't matter if they were in the worst argument or fight in the world. At 7 o'clock on Sunday, it was a reaffirmation of everything. And I think that in and of itself, that's what a compliment is underneath what the compliment is about. Each time you do, it's a reaffirmation of your experience, your feelings, and acknowledgement.
I think that sounds fantastic. It's absolutely true. A lot of times, particularly with our spouses, we're not respecting, you know, what they're doing, because we feel we get so used to what they do, we don't see it. And I suggest even taking a step back and look through the eyes of a stranger at your spouse. You know, watch them from across the room instead of standing next to them all the time, or, you know, across the ball field at your kids' or grandkids' games. You know, again, you get to start remembering what that was, what that spirit, that spark, that look that attracted you to, and you have to keep reclaiming that. You absolutely do. But those extra neurons that you get with this mind-body-heart connection, you know, by complimenting, that builds pretty strong, you know, lifelong love connection that we all strive for in our marriages and long-term romantic relationships.
Yeah, but the other side of that is if you look at your spouse through somebody else's eyes and they're out there, you have to go run and grab them before somebody else does.
There you go. There you go. Well, you know, it doesn't hurt to unleash a little flirt with that person, you know.
No, of course not. You know, and you look back,
I just call it's sweet talk. You know, you don't have to be an expert in this. You can find little things. We hold back on compliments sometimes waiting for something big. But it really can be small things. You know, how great they look in that shirt, brings out the color of their eyes, you know, those kind of things. And the truth is that they just want to know that they're still attractive to you. and that, you know, our passionate feelings are connected to our sense of self. So we want to know that we're so attractive to our mate. So complimenting on that is not disingenuous at all. So
no.
Just practice a little sweet talk.
No, and by the way, where did this start with you? Where was it that you sat back and realized the power of a compliment and decided that you better put this together and you were going to put it to pen? Where was it for you? What happened in your life at that time?
Well, I realized I did a little bit of soul searching and what I wanted to do with my life, as some of us were getting older do. And one of the things that I answered that I would love to do, whether or not I got paid for, was to compliment people. And I thought, wow, where did that come from? So I started to do some investigating, and I correlated the fact that, you know, I've had my share of things that haven't gone right in my life, and yet I've been able to maintain this positive outlook. I've had bosses who called me one of the more positive people they've been around, like, hey, let's get her take on it. She's always got a good take. And it's not some sort of pie-in-the-sky Pollyanna attitude. It's really an ability to focus in on what's happening well. And I've used compliments to boost my own mood all the time. If I was headed home from work, had to stop at the grocery store, been a long day, I would compliment someone before I left the store. A shopper I'm passing on, say, you know, look at that great color on you today. And I always left the store and showed up at home in a better mood. So I really did investigate this power of appreciation that wraps together generosity and gratitude, respect, acknowledgement, all a host of spiritual and compelling qualities into this sweet little pay-it-forward gift.
Now, by the way, that really is what it's about. It is a pay-it-forward. You know, we really, in one way, shape, or form, as human beings, we're all linked together somehow. And not getting into, you know, into metaphysics and whatever, but we are linked. And I'll bet any amount of money, if somebody sat down with somebody else from 1,000 miles away, and you've never met him before in your life, and you sat down and have a cup of coffee, you would find a lot of things that you would have in common. And maybe the way you brought up, the way you went to school, the way how you look at life. And I also believe that true if you go to a different country. Once you get beyond the politics and et cetera, you get into the culture, we're all the same.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, and that's where compliments can help get past things like judgment or, you know, help build respect between people. Because, again, like you said, you're finding this common denominator, something to compliment in someone that you're recognizing the positive. It's very powerful. They say there are two ways to be the light. You can either be your own light or be the mirror that reflects it. And I look at compliments as reflecting back to people's brilliance, and that allows them to own it and see it. And hopefully build that as a good habit, particularly with your children.
You know, it's interesting when we talk about with compliments. I as you're talking, this thought was starting to bubble up inside of me, and that we are nothing more than what we see in life. Our life is nothing more than a mirror image of who we are, why we are, what we are. It may look a little bit different, but the only thing that you do is you recognize something familiar in someone else. And the compliment, and it's very interesting, when you compliment, you're really complimenting yourself because you're recognizing something in them that you either do or how you are or how you feel, how you experience. And compliments not only give that other person that boost, that adrenaline rush, the endorphins that you're talking about, that it gives you that same thing. So it's a reversible cause and effect.
Absolutely. That's the real secret of compliments, because most people have gotten a compliment, you know, you asked at the beginning of the show, and they think the power is in getting them, but the power in compliments is really in giving them. And that's what allows you to constantly refocus in on the good, speak it. You know, if you just think something good, that's not the same as actually acknowledging it for someone. And you bring that to life for them, and as you just said, for you as well.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. And I really believe, and that's not running through the life giving everybody a compliment just to, you know, to do it out there. But it's that time when it's in your mind. If you think about it, then you'll do it. If it's not triggered, if somebody is not saying this is what a compliment is, this is what a compliment does, if you're not thinking about it, for the most part, it's not going to come up. But if it's in your mind, if it's in the back of your head, if you have the book, The Compliment Quotient, sitting on your dining room table or your living room table, it causes you to think. And I think that in and of itself is critical.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've got some great tips in there. I call them complimentology strategies on how to get yourself aware of whether you're complaining more than you're complimenting, and some strategies to use them with your spouse, you know, with your girlfriends, with your children, and then just with people that you meet on the street, as well as more success. You know, getting a better income can be directly tied. As a matter of fact, it has been shown to tie to whether or not, you know, you have this form of social generosity, which is interpreted through compliments.
Yeah, and there are times when you compliment people and you see them get beet red, and then they flush, and they're almost ready to pass out. So you gotta grade it between a 1 and a 10. We grade between the 1 and the 10 power compliment. The 10 is going to knock them on their whatever, and the 1 is kind of a little one. So don't you have to kind of be aware of who you're giving the compliment to?
Absolutely. You know, I hate to say, but in this day and age, you do have to be a little bit, you know, circumspect with who you're complimenting, especially when you get into the male and female arena. And I always say to men, you know, if it's a compliment you wouldn't mind your wife hearing, or, you know, somebody could compliment your daughter, you know, absolutely, that's a completely appropriate to share. And I think one of the ways that I've seen people like CEOs and studied how they compliment is a lot of times they'll compliment someone indirectly. So they'll compliment, say, hey, Joe, look at that great job that, you know, Jack just did on that report. So they're sort of doing it indirectly, and that's another way that you could do that as well.
Now, by the way, most people learn indirectly. If you compliment directly, if you say something to someone directly, and there's not even any control of this, that mind of yours immediately defenses out, and sometimes the compliment can be taken in a completely different form. So we do have to be careful about how we compliment, but the idea is to be able to do it and to be able to judge how you're doing. I think that was brilliant if you had said, you know, do it through a third party. That way they get to hear it. It's not directly at them, and they can't in any way, shape, or form take it any way than you meant it.
Right, right. That's definitely one of the suggestions that I give in the book.
Yeah. Now, by the way, how do you walk up to somebody? And I'm serious about this. You walk up to somebody and you say, "Gee, I really think you're cute." All right. That's a very interesting thing to say, because if you say that, look at all of the side trips that we can go on. You know, what does that mean? Yada yada yada. And I think that people need to be taught. And I'm going to go back to training. you got to be taught how to do a compliment, when to do it, and the power of the compliment based on who you're dealing with. And if the book is the guideline, the path to do it, then you're good. It's not something that we automatically know. These are things we have to learn.
Right. I do have some great suggestions, particularly, again, you know, with that compliment of you look cute. If you have to start with the seed of truth, and you can't
always... Oh, by the
way,
thanks. By the way, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome. You do. Oh, radio is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
As long as it's truthful.
Yeah, I'm surprised you saw it all the way through the microphone. No,
you can't always take how they take it. You know, you long as you're honest and genuine with how you gave it, you can't control. Because some people aren't going to take it right, and you just kind of have to get out of there, either because they interpret it wrong or they're in such a negative mood or whatever. So long as you're giving it in a genuine way that's sincere, you obviously can learn. And I talk a little bit about, you know, you don't want to give it with a stalker stare, you know, the difference between a come on and a compliment. And it's pretty clear to most everyone when you're in the middle of them. So,
yeah, and I really believe, again, if you know what you're doing before you do it, then obviously it's going to come out the way that you wanted it.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, or something like that. Okay, we're going to run out of time. Let me ask you this. A website we can find you at?
Absolutely. It's complimentquotient.com, and that's compliment with an I, and then quotient, Q-U-O-T-I-E-N-T. And I've got a great little mini poster there that has compliments. They'll make you an expert complimentologist for the day and have people running to get compliments from you. So please check
that
it out.
That should be good. Wait, that, so Radio Susie just looked at me and said, yeah, wrong guy to say that to. By the way, thank you so much. Monica, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I've appreciated every moment you've been here. And that's
well,
a real compliment.
Thank you. That was a delightful thing to say to me. A nice compliment. I appreciate the time so much.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you were listening to Dresser After Dark. David Cowan coming up with this right after this.
In return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. David Ian Cowan, or Ian Cowan, is with us, navigating the collapse of time, a peaceful path through the end of illusion. He's a biofeedback trainer and teacher in spiritual communication and the art of dowsing, a former musician, counselor, and alternative health practitioner, and a trainer. He lives in Boulder, Colorado, where he runs a licensing program in spiritual healing to a variety of health practitioners. And let us say hi. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. We talk about navigating the collapse of time. David, do we ever get a definition of what time is?
Well, it's hard to define something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Let me explain that. Time is it's an invention. It's a mental construct. It's an adjustment, you might say, to this particular experience on the earth in bodies at this particular period of our unfoldment as a species. And so because of its ephemeral nature, it's very difficult to pin down. You know yourself that time, it doesn't really have a constant quality to it. It can drag when you're sitting in the dentist's office or when you're enjoying a good movie. It just seems to fly by. So it really is a psychological construct, and it kind of evades definition, if you know what I mean.
Sure, that's really where many people try to confine it into a definition, and it's not. It's just like, we're going to talk about the future, it just happened, it's gone.
Yeah, there you go.
In a millisecond, yeah, in a millisecond. You can never be in the same place at the same time within that millisecond, because the moment that you hear that you get it and you connect, it's already gone. And I think that's
right.
The biggest problem with people. They try to create things that isn't there. And when you get beyond that realm and you look at, you know, you look at all of the different writings in the past and all of the things that they saw which would apply to today, it goes beyond, for most people, the ability to define. Because I've felt for so many years now, David, how do you define the undefinable? And the moment that you think you can do that, you have no idea what you're talking about.
Very well put. All we can deal with is thoughts and images, and they really just are an attempt to slice up reality. But the mental image that I've been working with lately for time, and it seems to be working in the sense that you know, it doesn't create any stress or trauma for me, is the idea of a spherical model, that time is unfolding, much like an expanding universe, with all of these multiple possible connections or linear relationships between events, which we might experience as past, present, and future. So I call those, they're timelines. And the experience I'm having in this moment is a timeline that I chose or determined by all the decisions I've made in the past. When I make a new decision, especially one that's perhaps brand new to me, perhaps undoing an old pattern and taking a new direction, I literally create a new timeline of experience. It's almost as if I step out of one world or one possible world and step into another because of my decision. So on this level, again, it's the mind that is creating our experience of time.
Okay, so that would be the illusion then.
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, time, space,
and
bodies...
By the way, I'm listening to you very closely, and I'm seeing what you say. I'm writing down something as you're talking. But keep going. So
yeah.
If I can, in a moment, I can change it, can't I?
Yes, you can. And I guess the trick to doing that is realizing that we're creating it in the first place. As long as I'm still, you know, in my identity as a self-contained, separated being, I'm not necessarily going to get it that events are coming from me rather than to me. So there is a shift in perception and awareness where suddenly I make the connection between my previous thoughts and my direct experience. And once I start making that connection, then I can begin to... Well, it's like you have to find the reins before you can direct the horse. You have to realize that you are in control of this process, whether conscious or unconscious of it. Once we become conscious of it, then we can start making decisions based on the highest good of all, the good for humanity, the good for the planet, etc.
So what I wrote down is, I'm listening to you, what I wrote down was basically we're a moment-by-moment collection of who you are and what you are. And the transition can happen in a millisecond if you shift your perception of all of those things. If you take on a different definition of what your life is, what your world is, how you interact with everybody else. And
yeah.
And then what I also heard you say underneath the words was that you can do it anytime you want to do it and reshift and shift and reshift until it comes out the way that you want to. And if you reshift with other people, the collaboration is there and you're all moving in the same direction as opposed to each other.
Yes, and that's a great way of describing the opportunity that we now have collectively on the planet, as the experience of time is definitely connected with cosmological cycles and opportunities, you might say, within the experience of time to step up to the next octave or the next dimension, you might say, of perception. And so the Mayans said this, 3,000 years ago when they developed the calendar, that the purpose of time and the end of this particular plan or dispensation of time will culminate in our knowing, and this is going to be a collective experience, our knowing ourselves as conscious co-creators of realities. Right now, we're beginning to suspect
that. Let me hold you up, because that's extremely important, what you just said. We are conscious co-creators of our reality. You take a kid in the Middle East who's been taught that everybody else is hateful if they don't believe your way, and you cut off their heads and you blow them up. Okay, this is a mindset, and this effectively is their reality, and it's not your reality. But what would happen at that moment when everybody got a collective reality that went forward with everybody as opposed to, when was it the world was supposed to end a couple of weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity. I would think it would be great if the world would end in the way we know the world would end. What if we took that date and everybody decided to shift the way they thought, which would shift their consciousness?
That's all it would take.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what the calendar is about, just setting us up for a mutual, giving ourselves permission to change the way we look at each other and the world.
Sure. You get somebody who has a debilitating disease, and it's horrible, and they're frightened, and all of a sudden they get that, oh, well, this is a good thing, because now I'm looking this way, and I can go out and help people. All of a sudden, they've died.
Yeah.
In their mind. That old mindset died, and they were reborn, and they moved forward.
You know, there's another perspective you can also take, and this is something that came to me just the other week. According to physicists, this is a vibrating universe. All energy is in different states of vibration, and of course, the slower the vibration, the more likely it will appear to us as solid matter. But if the universe is vibrating, it basically means we're going off and on all the time. Every split millisecond, the universe is changing form because of this vibrational nature. Vibration implies constant change. And so it's in that vibration of the millisecond that the world ends and the world begins, and the world ends and the world begins, all perhaps a million times with every breath.
You want a great example of that? Go out on a date and go to a place where people dance. And
I'll have to check with my wife on that one, but okay.
Yeah, and the musicians are playing in sync. They're synchronized in the rhythms, and the rhythms are those vibrations. They're synchronizing the vibration. And when you dance, you're dancing to a vibration, and that's exactly what you're talking about. It's that vibration that you get caught up in, coming from the musicians to the instrument, to the people out there on the dance floor, but the moment itself is in and of the vibration. So, yes, there's validity to that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time to be here, and I frankly feel privileged to be at this particular juncture in time and history, because I think, you know, we don't have a precedence. We don't have a memory in our history of what we're coming to. It's the most significant shift or change on the planet, more significant than the agricultural revolution, more significant than perhaps even, you know, the discoveries of continents, etc. We're about to discover our oneness and our essential unity as a unified being.
Now, by the way, I have the book in front of me, and I open the book to page 114, and it has to do with reverse evolution. We can be proactive in the cellular memory clearing process, and that's really what it is. You clear cellular memory, and then you can create anything you want from there. And if everybody's collaborative with it, then you create something that's good for everybody.
Yes. And the good news, Michael, is that we are collaborative in it. DNA itself is a multidimensional communication system. So although, again, on the level of form of bodies, it appears that we're having separate experiences and separate lives, our DNA is all resonating as one already now. And it does this through specific quantum communication structures, which researchers have found in the body and have validated this notion that the DNA is in communication through subspace and quantum principles. Again, these principles, although they sound, you know, as far out as any wild metaphysical system you could think of, are rock-solid science. It's actually the water molecules that our DNA molecules are nested in that give the DNA this communicative potential. So we truly are in touch with each other. And this is what is so encouraging, is that when one person clears the memory, let's say, of an old grievance, an old grievance for themselves, this is instantly communicated to every aspect of life on this planet, not only human DNA, but plant and animal, and the vibration rises up just that much more. So we really are very powerful as individuals as how we can affect the whole by simply allowing the information that's held in ourselves, which is the history of life in this universe, to come forward, to look at it with neutrality, release ourselves from any judgment around that experience, offer forgiveness and let it go. Everybody benefits.
Now, by the way, as the consciousness shifts, let's go back to the end of the world, quote unquote, but the hurricanes, the tornadoes that have hit recently, there's an old law, and that physics law in physics says two opposing forces can't occupy the same place at the same time. And everything's got a vibration to it, whether it's a plant-animal vibration and human vibration. There's also a vibration that is in the nucleus of this earth. And if the vibration of the earth wants to stay constant and the vibration of human beings is going through change, the opposing forces can't occupy the same place at the same time, and you're going to have earthquakes, you're going to have all of these things, and I think that's what's going on hypothetically at this moment.
Well, it's a reasonable model, and I think anything that we can draw on to bring sanity in at this time is valuable. These are all models, and models serve us in that they give us a context, they give us something to accept on a mental and emotional level so that we can have the grace to move through these times without fear. So I love these models. They work for me.
Yeah, by the way, they work for me also. And doing the kind of the lifestyle that I have and doing the things I do, I keep my fingers on pretty much the pulse of everything that goes on. And it's very interesting to watch what goes on day by day by day politically as they shift vibration. Forget left and right, it doesn't matter. As they shift the vibration. And somebody will get accused of something and somebody will do something about it and say this, this, and that. And they'll shift in the way they think to be able to protect themselves. And you watch the vibrational change. It is all vibration underneath it. And if you become aware of it, you can see the dynamic of what occurs, why it occurs, and what the outcome is going to be.
Exactly. I agree.
Okay. I picked the book up, Navigating the Collapse of Time, A Peaceful Path Through the End of Illusions. David, I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I read the book?
Well, my intention is that you will be able to release any anxiety or uncertainty you may have had around these topics, again, largely due to either misinformation or incomplete information. The media today is actually surprisingly opening up to reporting many of the and the scope of changes that are going on. But if you don't get the whole picture, it's very natural for us to go into fear. So my intention with reading the book is to diffuse that fear, to free us up to be able to not only survive this time, but actually to thrive and become proactive in it. In the book, I talk about a phenomena described first by Barbara Clough, who also wrote the foreword to the book, and she calls this phenomena catastrophobia. And she very insightfully discovered that we as a species have a cellular memory of previous cataclysmic periods on the Earth, periods of dramatic change, in many cases physical change, what many call, you know, the sinking of Atlantis or the destruction of Mu and these types of things that are really relegated to the field of legend and myth, because our written history simply doesn't go back that far. But she says the memory is written in our cells, in our DNA. So when we hear about these topics, when we hear about earthquakes and floods and tsunamis, something's triggered on a cellular level, like, oh, I better take care of myself, I better take shelter. And when we move into that reaction based on previous experiences, we really are immobilized. Fear is a contractive emotion. So we lose the creative potential in the moment. We lose the ability to think creatively about the most beneficial and positive things to do in the face of change. So the intention of the book really is to diffuse the potential for catastrophobia to take over and to really flip that around and see this time of change, albeit some of it perhaps apparently chaotic, but to see this as a golden opportunity and a wonderful transition, much like a birthing. You know, if you stepped into a birthing situation and you weren't familiar with what that was all about, you would at first go into anxiety. You'd be hearing painful screams and you'd be seeing people running around, not realizing that this is a necessary process in the bringing forth of new life. So I guess that's what I hope and intend that people will go away with, is a sense of this is all appropriate, and no matter what happens, the worst that can happen is that I physically die, and from what I now understand, that's not even possible. So I can begin now to relax into the process and perhaps even take a proactive and a creative approach to how I can help others, you know, come to peace and perhaps understand the bigger picture.
David Cowan, we're just about out of time. A website we can
You're
find
fading
you.
Fading out there.
Say again? Oh, okay.
So
website.
You cut out.
We're cutting out. That's interesting. Okay. Website we can find you at.
Yes. Thank you for asking. It's www.bluesunenergetics, all one word, .net. So bluesunenergetics.net. We actually named the website after the Hopi prophecy regarding 2012, where they said that a second sun will appear in the sky, a blue sun, and this will be a marker that we have transitioned to a fifth dimensional planet.
And let somebody try to debate that when it happens. Okay. David, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's falling. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends,